Welcome to Strong Black Laughs, the show that brings you the Black champions of comedy, brought to you by Netflix and Strong Black Leave. Each week, we talk to comedians who've given us an escape from the bullshit. That job, them kids, and those problems that just won't go away. People who've made us rethink our lives and the world around us. And most of all, made us laugh our asses off. Roy Wood Jr. is one of the funniest brothers in the game right now. If you watch a Comedy Central at any given night, you're sure to see his face pop up on the screen at least once or twice. He's a daily correspondent on The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. He's the host of the network storytelling series, This Is Not Happening. And he has two specials of his own on the network. But Roy didn't just get to where he is by being funny. He put in the work. He's been doing comedy long before we started seeing him all across our TVs. He used to be a radio guy. He's got his start in his home state of Alabama. You know how hard it is to start in Alabama? He has one of those stories that should only be told in a Hollywood movie. That's right. He's been here doing all the things, and his hard work is paying off. If you didn't know about him before, it's time for you to catch up. I had a chance to talk to Roy about how he got to where he is today. And to no surprise, he's not just funny, he's wise too. He dropped some truths, he made some jokes, and we had a good laugh. Take a listen. Hi, I'm Janelle James, and this is the Strong Black Laughs podcast. Today, I am here with the amazingly hilarious, the only nigga I take tags from, Roy Wood Jr. If you don't know what a tag is, that's when people come up to you after the show and they say, you know what you should say during that joke that you spent a lot of time on? Let me, this other person that doesn't do comedy, tell you, or even other comedians, this man is the only person I want to hear it from.
So. Here's how to be better at your job. Shut the fuck up. You know, advice of being better at my job.
Roy Wood Jr., thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. A pleasure to see you.
It's going to be very formal.
All right.
All right, so we're going to get into some early life things, such as where you're from, which is Birmingham, Alabama.
Yeah.
I feel like people know that just from listening to you talk.
It depends on how drunk I am, though. There's days where I can, I don't want to say hide the accent, but there was enough in journalism school to professionalize it. And then the moment that whiskey hit, man, what's up, bro? You already know what it is, cuz shit, goddamn, we in this bitch, you feel me? Like, it'll, like, but immediately I can come back and be a refined person.
Are you doing it, do you think you're doing it midway on The Daily Show?
Yeah, The Daily Show, it's, I know that my comedic strength is the accent. The accent helps because I sound dumb, but talk smart.
Mm.
So it's kind of that juxtaposition that I'm trying to create. Plus, if I get too excited, it comes out, and I ain't got time to be hiding it. Fuck it, this is who I am, this is how I talk.
Nice.
So that's just what it is.
Okay. So Birmingham, Alabama is the birthplace of the Civil Rights Movement. Wasn't your dad a Civil Rights?
My dad was deep off in that shit. So my father, he was one of the first Black anchors, first Black news anchors on a lot of mainstream white radio. And also was one of the first hires at the National Black Network in Chicago. So the NBN was essentially Black CNN of its era in the early 60s and 70s, we'd say. My father was an embedded reporter, Vietnam. He was embedded with Black units that were facing racism in Vietnam. My father was on the front line standing next to soldiers getting shot at. The riots in Soweto in South Africa, my father was there. Pretty much any civil rights picture, this is for real, any civil rights picture you can show me from the 60s, you see Dr. King, my dad is probably two rows back. Tape recorder, ink pen, getting hit over the head, getting hit with a brick, just like everybody else. The only difference was he was there documenting it. So, you know, it's weird because my father's journey in pointing out bullshit and speaking, you know, about Black righteousness and making sure that Black people get what they're owed from this country was never really my lane. Like, that was never anything I really wanted to do.
Don't you feel like you're just doing it in a different way?
That's what's so crazy about it is that you spend your 20s trying to not be your parents, and 30s transitioning, and your 40s, and I'm 40 now, you spend your 40s accepting.
I'm just like that, Nick.
They drive around, talk shit to Black folks, and tell them to get their shit together. The only difference is I make them laugh. My daddy did it in the church. I do it in the comedy club.
Were you exposed to a lot of comedy in Alabama?
It wasn't until we got cable in our house that it kind of opened up the world of comedy and, like, the concept of stand-up as a thing. I was never really funny growing up. It wasn't until high school. Until high school, I was in a different school district every 2 years. So the pressure of fitting in requires you to just shut the fuck up. Mm-hmm. Like, you, I ain't got time to be cracking jokes. Yeah, I don't know y'all. Y'all don't crack on me. So let me just be quiet. Sinbad was an early influence. Young people will never remember this. But once a year, HBO would give you a free preview weekend where you had all the channels. You had HBO, you had Showtime, you had Cinemax. And during that weekend, that's when HBO would show all of their best programming to try and make you a subscriber.
Yeah, yeah.
So it would always coincide with a big comedy special, and one of them was Sinbad. And we VCR'd that bitch, and I wore that tape out. Then a couple of years later, Comedy Central signed on. And so when Comedy Central signed on, they started showing stand-up clips and snippets and Comic Justice with A.J. Jamal and Stand-Up with Wally Collins and, like, these compilation shows of just clips. And then once BET's Comic View came into the game in the late 90s, that was kind of when it was kind of off to the races.
As you're watching Sinbad and all those things, are you like, I'm going to do that, or are you just enjoying it?
I was enjoying it, and then I started putting the pieces together at school, because the only time I was funny in high school was when we played baseball. I was a bench warmer, mm-hmm. and your job as a bench warmer is to heckle the opposing team. That's literally... like your job. Your job is to just say hateful things across a baseball field at other 16-year-olds to demoralize them. And you could see the parents chuckle. And when I got the parents, I know I got you because I just made your mama laugh at you. Like, we would scope you from the time you got out the fucking car in the parking lot to walk over to your dugout. Like, I would, we talk about your mama's car. And you're playing the same team 2-3 times a year. So you keep a little log and, like, oh, I know number 14. His mama got the cutlass. And just, so to the point where I would sit and write specific heckles before the game. So you're essentially, you're making a set list.
Right. I'm sure, like, around that point now, people are like, well, you funny. You should.
Yeah, but I didn't want to try it because I finally fit in. It wasn't until college where I ain't had shit to lose. Like, when you go to college, you get a new identity. And right. So once you're in college, it's like, all right, it don't matter if people don't like me. Yeah, I don't know you motherfuckers. But in high school, everything right. was perfect. I was cool. I wasn't the coolest, but I was cool. I had the girl. I had me a raggedy-ass Dodge Aries. I had a good job at Subway. This is back when Subway was still a respected fast food establishment. Very upper crust, like what Chipotle is now. That's what Subway was back in the day.
It was like, actually fresh.
Yeah. You walk in with a Subway bag, niggas be like, oh, with the Subway? Look at you, Mr. Fucking Sandwich Man. And so I didn't want to risk it. So I just didn't try stand-up. And also the comedy club in Birmingham, which is still standing to this day, the Stardome is a legendary club. It was all the way on the white side of town. So you live in a city where the bus system is shit. I know my mom ain't gonna take me because she's taking lost classes and shit at night. So her plate is full. The White Mall is just another fucking universe when you're 16. Like, we literally only went to Hoover, Alabama when it was time for Christmas shopping. To go to Red Lobster. There was also a time
when
Red Lobster was a respectable establishment that you put on a goddamn collared shirt for. But nobody believes me when I say that shit.
So you didn't start doing stand-up until you got in college?
Yeah, I went until I got in college.
In college, are you doing, like, college shows? Or are you, like, leaving school to go to clubs? You doing the open mics?
I'm working the road. I mean...
Really?
We've talked about this... in passing, but not really in depth. Mm-hmm. So when I was 19, I got arrested for stealing jeans. And so because I got arrested...
I would have remembered that. I don't think you've ever told me that.
No. Look, my whole stand-up shit was nothing about no dare at an open mic. And I bet you won't get up there. No. I thought I was going to prison. Mm-hmm. So before I go to prison, let me do everything I've ever wanted to fucking do in my life. Comedy was on the list. And that was it. The concept of probation, which is what I ended up on, didn't even register. I was like, oh, I'm going to go to prison. Because the number one show at the time was Oz. I'm like, all right, well, I'm going to get murdered. So let me go ahead and figure out.
Do my bucket list.
Yeah, I'm going to do my bucket list.
So how old are you now at this point? 19?
I'm 19 years old.
Oh, that's...
I'm 19 years old. I'm facing 5 years in prison. And I get a financial aid check for $7,000. The next day, I got a letter from Florida A&M University telling me that I was suspended from school for the year, mm-hmm. for my misconduct. Mm-hmm. That's fair. Could have expelled me, mm-hmm. but thank God, black college, looking out. Gave a brother
second chance. Everybody get one.
Yeah. So essentially what I have now is a year off of school and $7,000 in my hand. And you're going to prison in 6 months. Mm. Fucking ball out. So I started taking the Greyhound and just working wherever, because in the South, open mic is once a month. All this LA, Chicago, New York, open mic all over town every night, fuck no. You get one chance a month to be funny for 5 minutes.
Right.
And then you spend the next 3.5 weeks evaluating that audio. So the only way to get on stage every week is to travel.
Right.
I had no fucking car.
Right.
So I just hopped the dog. I go on the Greyhound everywhere.
And so you didn't go to prison.
No. And yeah. So when I, so here's how it worked out. Mm-hmm. So I essentially had a year of just introducing myself into numerous comedy markets with the money to back it. So by the time, fam, you let me back in class, I had already done the groundwork all over the South to establish myself. So now I'm working as an opener or a feature on the weekend. So when I get back in school, I consolidate my classes to Tuesday through Thursday. And Thursday night, I take the dog and go somewhere Friday, Saturday, Sunday, work the weekend. Sunday night, take the Greyhound back to Tallahassee. Monday morning, back in class and working at Golden Corral on weeknights to cover rent, because I was essentially breaking even. At this point, the 7 G's was gone. I had spent all that. But, you know, my comedy beginnings were essentially like a gift. Like, it really was a gift. And so I graduate from school with a degree in journalism and 3 years of experience in comedy under my belt at this point. So journalism don't pay shit.
Right.
So when I graduated from college, my 2 job offers were about $15,000. I did the math on what I've been making up until that point in comedy and just did projections of the next 3 years. I would have made 18 that first year out of college, just telling jokes.
Right.
And then expenses and gas and all that shit, but just 18K in my hand just seemed better than 15. So I just stayed doing comedy and I moved back to Birmingham. This is 2001. And I go to my mom and I go, yo, look, for as long as I make more money each year than I did the year before, give me another year in your house, up to 3 years. And so that was
that's a better deal than most kids. It's still living with their mom.
Because you're trying to explain, with a plan. But you're also talking to a woman with 3 degrees and a law degree.
Right.
And she was, I'll say this about my mom. Even when she didn't understand my choices, she always supported me. Which is, I can always say, she, on that number one fan shit.
Mm-hmm. So at this point, you're doing comedy just in the South?
Yeah. So now I'm an official
road. You a comic. You're a road dog.
I'm a road comic. My mom found out I was sleeping in bus stations, so she put down on a Ford Focus for me. So now I had a road car to properly go out, and it tripled my reach. Mm-hmm. So now I'm doing morning radio. I have an internship. Ricky Smiley just left the morning show to go to Dallas, so I'm interning at the morning show, and if the gig is under 5 hours, I would U-turn and come back to Birmingham that night. Right. So I was doing 5-hour quick flips, as I called them. So I would go to Louisville, tell jokes, drive back, be back in Birmingham at 4 a.m, sleep in the station, get up at 6, do my job as an intern, nap till noon in a production room under a desk,
right.
Get back in the car, 5 hours to Louisville to do the show the next night. So that was the journey for probably the next 5 or 6 years, just working my way up to headliner.
Do you feel like comedians that are starting now have any concept of the amount of any of that?
No.
Journey that you had to go through.
No. There's differing ways to work it. Now, the problem that new comics have is that the job pays the same as it did in 98 as a road comic. You get $125 on average to open. You get anywhere from $200 to $250 to close as a headliner. If you're a no-name with no credits, those numbers can slide a little bit, but for the most part, you're barely squeaking by. Gas is triple what I paid in 2001 to drive around. So it's to the point now when young people ask me how to do it, I wouldn't even recommend my path.
Yeah, doing the road.
I don't even know if I could recommend that to you, because you could take that money that you're spending and losing on the road, breaking even. Like, let's say,
just move to a city.
Move to a city. Go be broke in a city that has more stage time regular.
Right.
Because if you're struggling, you're better off struggling somewhere where there's also other people struggling. And that's the biggest mistake that I made in my career. The only thing that I wish I could change about my career is leaving the South sooner. It's the only thing. My first 9 years, I was in the South, and I should have gone well before 2007.
You a big fish.
Yeah, but not only working your way up to being a big fish in a region that doesn't have all of the facilities that you need, because Atlanta wasn't what Atlanta is now. Mm-hmm. There wasn't all those opportunities. The indie scene wasn't there. The alt scene wasn't there. What Nashville is now is amazing. Mm-hmm. Compared to 98, it was one club.
Right.
So if you had a chance to go out on the road and make the same $800 I made for the week, and you kill $500 of that on gas and expenses, you netted $300. You better off staying at the crib, getting you a job that make you $400, and then taking that money and doing a video or doing something that gives you reach, right, which gives you an audience. And I think that's the one thing that a lot of these Instagram and YouTubers and Viners and, you know, a lot of the traditional stand-ups tend to rail against. That's what they figured out. A lot of those kids are byproducts of comedy clubs that told them no. So they went home in front of their fucking webcam and figured out a way to do something. And now they come back to that same venue that you at and sell tickets around your ass.
Right.
So there's other paths, there's other ways to do it. But for what I did, that's what worked for me. But that's also the other mistake you make as a performer, is that you chase other people's, you chase your predecessor's dreams. Like, you inherit the goals of your ancestors.
Who's that for you?
Well, just all the niggas that came before me. When I was an opener, I opened for niggas who was dying to get on late night. Man, you gotta get on Comic View, man. You get on Comic View, and then be the hood. But by the time I got Comic View, the shit was, it was over.
Yeah.
By the time I got Letterman in 06, and that was a blessing. But Letterman in 06 ain't Letterman in 96.
Right.
Those are two totally different trajectories of your career after performing. It's two different decades. So I just feel like I should have been in a bigger city faster, surrounded by other people who had the same dreams as me.
You wouldn't call them regrets
you
now.
You ain't know no better. That's why I tell these young niggas, don't listen to me.
But like, I feel like you're not a hater, like you just said. I feel like most people would be like, nah, you gotta do the road, you gotta put in your dues, you just basically broke it down why that's a bad idea.
Path is your path.
You're like one of the only people that anyone should listen to.
You gotta figure out your way through this based on the landscape and listen to your instincts. Your instincts are what drove you to be a comic in the first place. That's why, like,
everybody not gonna make it, because everybody don't have instincts. And, right?
That's why.
You don't know how to, figure out.
That's why I hate when comedians love to go on their fuck Dane Cook rants without acting like that man didn't invest money in himself and leverage a platform
and
that nobody was fucking with at the time and make himself a draw. And found his audience. Because that waiting around to just do a bunch of late night sets,
I never understood the whole fuck Dane Cook. Like, what is the, that he's successful? Like, what is...
There was the joke stealing, and him and Louis had beef, and so a lot of comics pick sides. But aside from that, just as a business model of identifying something where comedy does not exist, and then putting comedy there, to me, it's two things that drive tech, comedy and porn. If you figure out a way to make people laugh or make people want to fuck, the platform blows up. Mm-hmm. There's a digital platform you can name that doesn't rest on the backs of comedians or some level of, like, what Snapchat started out with fucking dick pics.
Right.
And then they're like, oh, we can make this funny.
Yeah.
So if you want to be smart about your comedy, man, figure out where the tech is going.
You want TikTok?
Not yet. The Daily Show has a TikTok account, and I did some goofy shit for them, and it got like 1 million views, and I'm like, fuck, I should have had TikTok. I could have got some of them followers. I said, I did it, because I don't understand what they had me do. Because the digital team at The Daily Show, they go, all right, do this, count to 8, and then do this, and then we're going to put music under it. I'm like, all right,
you
whatever.
Need a team. Well, that's another thing people don't understand. A lot of people who are doing all these things have a team.
Okay, so then there is somebody with a dream that is intersects with yours.
Wants to do videos.
Or find the camera nigga, and then, hey, camera nigga, would you like something different to shoot? Yes, I would, comedian nigga. And then you shoot it, and then you go, hey, editing nigga, would you like to edit?
That was
some
hard
shit?
ER.
Because he white.
Editing niggas always white. Okay.
And you figure out a way to do profit sharing or working, or you figure out a way, you can figure out the money, but more importantly, it's about creating product that you all have an opportunity to take a part of to grow your own platform.
Right.
So, I'm not going to say and do everything for experience and for your reel and all of that shit, but it's not as hard as you think if you're willing to do the work.
I'm exhausted by all the things that we're supposed to do as comedians. Do you feel that exhaustion in that you're supposed to have a TikTok and a Twitter and a Instagram and do stand up and be on the radio and be on television and act.
Social media is the easy shit. That's not the work. The work is now. That's the craziest shit about comedy, is that you think everything you were doing was the climb, but that was just the beginning to get you to the real training. I hate to use superhero movies, but it's Batman Begins. Batman got to walk up the mountain. He gets to the top of the mountain. He think that's it. And he goes, no, and the dude beats his ass. He goes, motherfucker, now we training. He's like, bitch, I just climbed a mountain. Mm. You're like, I don't give a fuck. You up here, this time, now is the time to work. So everything you've done up until making it is climbing the mountain. And then it's the training, because now it's, okay, you've made it. Now can you stay?
Mm.
Can you continue to pitch segments for The Daily Show that get you on? Oh, Comedy Central likes you. Here's an hour special, but you got to make sure to write that hour special and tighten it up at night
while also doing stuff, traveling
for The Daily Show. Oh, look, you just sold a sitcom pilot. Tell you what, why don't you go out to LA and meet with a couple writers and figure out a way to get that pilot done? Hey, have you finished the edit on your hour special that you just shot? Good job with that. By the way, that's going, that's coming out soon. Can you travel and promote that while being on The Daily Show, while working on the fucking pilot that you sold 2 months ago?
Yes. But can you also do that while still climbing a mountain? That's what I mean with comedy. You still do social
and
media.
And somewhere in there, you still got to put out a goddamn tweet about the comedy.
Exactly. That's what I mean.
And it's got to be engaging.
I'll do the mountain stuff. But
this is not a complaint.
Constant
climb. I'm just saying that it is a different juggling game the more you matriculate into comedy. And that's where it gets really scary.
So, you know how when people first start out, like, so I always say for 2 years I did Todd Barry, because that's who first took me on the road. I was just being monotone and not taking the mic out of the stand.
Yeah,
and
that was your impersonation.
Yes. Man. Did you have anybody like that where you're like, where you found yourself like, oh, I'm, or were you always your,
no,
yourself?
My first 2 years of stand-up was a crude Martin Lawrence impersonation. I went through a serious Martin Lawrence phase off the rip. Just, what? Wow, girl. Inflections up and down. What? Like, if you watch Martin, if you just watch the staccato of the tempo of how he talks.
You do a lot of, like, fast.
Correct, correct. Things, yeah. It's low volume, high face, or it's still face, high volume. What? Come on. Like, it's... So I was doing a lot of that. It was, and keep in mind, I was 19. I was talking about roommates eating my food and shit. Like, it was never anything highbrow. Mm-hmm. And then I went through a serious Paul Mooney and Doug Stanhope phase with my material, where I was trying to be super real and back at it. And I go back and watch some of that stuff now. I was just angry, and it didn't even look real, because I also have to accept, I think an important part as a performer, you have to accept how you're perceived. I don't think you really get to dictate how people see you as much as, all right, this is how y'all see me. Well, here's how we lean into that. I know that, or at least back then when I was 50 pounds lighter, I had a baby face. And so because my face is round, no one will ever process me as angry. You just won't believe it. It just doesn't come across. So if I'm gonna talk about edgy shit or real shit, I can say something edgy, but I cannot say it with a scowl like Mooney. I can't just be dismissive about it like Stanhope. I have to smile, which somehow allows people to process what I'm saying without being confused by whatever facial expressions that I'm making. So that's, I don't know, that's some weird sciencey shit.
That's some deep stand-up.
I like watching niggas on mute and just seeing what they face and body do on particular shit. Like, I watch a whole special and then I'll go back and watch it on mute to see certain things. Chris Rock is probably one of the best at it. And just being demonstrative and, you know, and really showing.
He always says he's a Baptist preacher. That's what he's doing.
Yeah.
The pacing, three times.
Back and forth.
Yeah. Most people probably know you from The Daily Show with Trevor Noah, but they may not know that you auditioned for the show previously when Jon Stewart was hosting.
Oh, it's terrible. It was one of the worst auditions I've ever done in my life. I go in the room and... it's a couple of producers, and they go, okay, here's the story. And they essentially give you a segment that they've done already on the show.
Mm-hmm.
I got in there, and I was just reading it. I wasn't performing it. And so I walk out of the room, and I left my phone in the room. So I have to wait for the person that went in after me to finish their audition so I can go back in to get my phone. And I'm just hearing laughs, laughs, and laughs. And person walks out the room is Wyatt Cenac.
Yes.
Went on to.
Yes. Who then went and got
Emmys and yes. writers and did everything with The Daily Show. And I went back in the room to get my phone. Everybody got quiet again. Like, you know, like everybody be having a good time. And then they're like, oh. They did that shit on me. I was like, yeah, but I ain't get this one. Knowing what I know now, I just didn't listen. I was so intent on reading, just as they call it in bad acting, waiting for your turn to talk.
Right.
Instead of listening to the person that you're in the
scene. And responding to.
Correct.
Yeah. So when the second time came around.
Well, I was ready. I was ready for that second time.
Did they do it the same way and like do the same segment?
Or yeah. They did both this time. They wanted you to write one and to perform one that they wrote for you.
Okay.
Just to see how you what your comedic sensibilities are, and can you perform stuff that we create for you as well. So the homie Neil Brennan gave me a call and was like, "Yo, Daily Show's looking for people, and drop your name." I was like, "Yes, motherfucker, drop my name."
Okay, Neil.
And so 2 weeks later, I got the call to come in and audition, and it was pretty solid.
So the Daily Show was something that you wanted. It wasn't.
I never considered it because. It's the type of show that you audition once, and once you shit the bed, that's it. That was mm-hmm. your chance. Mm-hmm. But Trevor coming in kind of reset, gave it a whole new feel. And Jon Stewart is a stand-up, but Trevor is younger, and Trevor was still, and even now, it's still more actively in stand-up and the touring side. Trevor wanted a different feel for what the correspondents were. And so he just wanted people that had opinions of the world that were also funny and lively. So off of my resume up until that point, that was enough to get me in.
Right.
Just for the audition.
So you're also hosting This Is Not Happening.
Yes.
Which is also on Comedy Central. So was that like part of the deal? They were looking for the new host?
No. You know what? This Is Not Happening came up because the former host and creator, Ari Shaffir, departed the show.
Right.
And that was something that was not, for my deal was already done. They were like, look, do The Daily Show. If you got a sitcom idea, bring that out. Hold on. Ari go. Hey, man, you want to host Ari show? Ari. And that's essentially that's how it happened. Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, being a part of the family, and it was cool to be able to, you know, host the show and kind of keep that whole thing going.
Do you think that it's a good platform for you? Because you're a good, like, storyteller type of, I think you do a good mix of both, like, of jokes.
If you know Ari Shaffir's comedy, though, comparative to mine, you know, Ari's a lot more edgier than me. And so I was like, I don't know if my stories match up to the tone of the show. And they were like, no. Your stories are fine. We just need good stories. It's all different types of comedians. And once they explained it that way, it made perfect sense. That show actually made me plug into that storytelling side
of
me that I'd never really even tried to do.
I want to talk about some of the things you have in the works, which, I mean, when you just went through the whole everything you have to do on the mountain tells me that you're busy. So you have the project with Aaron Magruder.
Aaron Magruder, Jefferson County Probation.
Can you tell us anything about that?
It's based on the probation officer I had when I got in trouble, who was hella lenient. That was the other thing. I had a probation officer that allowed me to travel to do stand-up, which is essentially against every policy.
So all of that was meant to be, basically.
I look at my life, man, and there's so many moments of luck. You just got to go, nah, that's God.
Mm.
A little too much luck. You can't have this much luck.
All the black people say, well.
You can't have a lawyer that got you back and a judge that's got you back and a university that let you back into school to get you back and then a probation officer who let you travel to pursue your dream, which ends up being your craft for the next 20 years. Like, that's too much luck.
Let me rub your leg like the Apollo log.
Yeah, so the show with Magruder is about showing the pros and cons of giving people second chances. And it's just an interesting look because probation is law enforcement. And it's something that people don't really think about because usually on television we show you the cop, the courtroom, or the jail.
Mm-hmm.
That's all you see. We never see what happens when you get out of jail.
Probation officers like bounty hunters on TV. Like some dude that just comes to track you down.
Yeah.
Are you saying that's not true?
And it's an interesting world of law enforcement that people don't know shit about. And so it's going to be fun. We're shooting down in Alabama. So that's been cool as well. So, you know, we're doing that. Daily Show, we're going to have 2020 coverage. So that's another thing that we got to gear for is all of the travel. With the presidential election. And an animated thing that I can't talk about right now.
Okay, cool. So the nigga busy is all he's saying.
Yeah.
And which is excellent. Is this your first pilot attempt at writing a scripted show? How's that going?
You just learn a lot about the process of writing and just how it's something that you shouldn't just discount. Like, now I understand when I watch award shows and then the actors get up there, it starts with the writing and I couldn't be up here. That's right, motherfucker, you did. So.
That's totally right. This portion of the show is a deep dive, and that's when we go back in your career to a bit or a moment in time, and then we talk about it. And this is it. Let's take a listen.
My uncle got the solution. My uncle, you want to lose weight, boy? What you need to get you a woman that can cook. You need a woman that can cook, boy. That's what you need. My uncle, one of them old black men, he can't talk without wobbling and doing that. You need a woman that's gonna get in that kitchen and throw down for you. And to me, it's not that important if a woman can cook or not. At this point in time in society, if you can't cook, it's fine. Can you read? Let's read a cookbook. Let's figure it out. As long as you bring something else to the table, we'll get by. It's fine. But my uncle won't let it go. My uncle, look, ain't nothing wrong with a woman having a job. But I'm telling you, when I was your age, I loved coming home to a hot meal on my table. Yeah. I bet you did love coming home to a hot meal. You was dating in the 60s. You couldn't eat nowhere in public. That was your only chance at a safe meal. Spent all day doing cardio, running from white folks. Yes, you need a nice meal at the house. I don't have to live how you live. We got desegregation and Chipotle. It's good times for me.
First, I want to say, just in general about your joke talent, like, you're like, you know that you're like one of the most well-respected joke writers. And how do you feel about, you're like our, like, I don't want to say joke dad, because then it's like you old or whatever, but you like the OG of, when I ask anybody, like, who do you respect? Like, who should you ask for advice? Like, everybody always says you. Like, how do you feel being that person for, like, a lot of comedians? You're like our...
It's an honor. There's days where I wonder if it's gonna sound dark, and I don't want you to. Don't turn into Oprah when I say this shit. And don't try to Yana Van Zandt fix my life for no shit.
Don't tell me what to do. Go ahead.
Sometimes I wonder if my career is for myself to get to where I want to be, or if my career is here to help other people.
Can it be both?
I don't know.
Why you make it so fatal? Okay, see, I'm doing it.
No, I'm just being real. Like, I think that we all have a role to play, and I think that we don't get to define it. Right. And something that I enjoy doing and something I tend to gravitate towards is just helping other comedians. I know at some point where comedy and entertainment is concerned, I would love to just be the dude comics could just talk to and ask whatever XYZ question, but you gotta be somebody that's serious about it. You gotta be, you know, really into the craft. Like, it's to the point now where, generally speaking, I won't even talk to comedians that have been doing it less than 3 years because I don't believe that you're going to stick with it. I know that at least at 2 to 3 years in, you've cried in the car, you've questioned everything, you've lost all your friends because you've asked everybody to come to your open mic show. So at this point, you're on the proper emotional island. You're at the top of that first mountain where the real growth can now begin. So if you're at that point, you know, I'll fuck with you and believe you. But there's a lot of comics that get fucked over in the game. And the old heads, I just wish that a lot of the old heads had, you know, stood up or at least said something or at least did something to try and change things. We live in a society, this isn't even an indictment on comedy. We live in a society where I only respect what you do if you suffered as much as I did to do it. And that's fucked up. Like, that, it ain't gotta be as hard for me as it was. Well, these motherfuckers getting on TV now after 3 years. That's the thing the old heads before me started bitching about, how long it took them to get on TV. And then late 90s, the curve went from like 7 years to get on TV to like 4, maybe 3. I would say I know comics a year and a half in that have TV credits now. There's also 900 fucking channels.
Right.
And they all need content. They all need comedians. So yes, people are gonna get on TV sooner now.
Right. It's okay. Heads don't wanna get on TikTok. You know what I mean? But the reason I even brought up how well respected you are is partly because of jokes like this. You have the ability to like take what would be like old cliche type things. Oh, women gotta cook, which old heads like, that might be the end of the joke, but you flipped it into a whole racial, you know, joke.
The idea is, where did that ideology come from? What are the circumstances in the lives of the generation of people who believe women could cook that drove them to want women that could cook? The joke can always be, well, this is what it is, isn't it what it is? Ah! But why is it that? That's the next level. That's the next layer to the bit. So everything that I try to evaluate, it's why is it that? It's not just women can cook. Lady, better get in that kitchen, get you a fat man. Get you a fat girl. I don't trust no skinny bitch. Can't no skinny bitch cook for me.
No.
That's fine, but no, right. I'd rather go, oh, yeah, segregation. That's probably why you wanted a woman who could cook, because y'all couldn't go nowhere.
Right. And now, I know me and you have spoken about this, in that when I started, and it's still a little bit now, that the majority of my fan base was white, and then trying to do like what I'm calling my reverse crossover and get some black audience, you are able to talk about these type of things in front of a variety of people. Like, who are you speaking to? Are you speaking to?
I'm speaking for myself.
You speaking to?
I speak to people who don't know everything that black people are going through, and I speak to black people who need confirmation that they're not crazy, and seeing the world the way they see it, and letting them know they're not alone.
Do you feel like you try to tailor your stuff based on what your crowd is?
No.
Right.
The only thing I might change up if the demo is slanted is delivery speed.
Mm.
And I don't want to get all science-y.
No, get into it.
Black people traditionally talk at a rate of speed, black performers. The biggest critique I know of black performers is that they talk at a rate of speed that white people can't keep up with, because white people don't have enough black friends to be able to keep up with how fast black people just, for us, we won't pick up on it because we've always talked to black people.
Mm.
So if it's a predominantly white crowd, let's say 80% white or something, and there's a joke that moves fast, I will slow it down a little bit more so that you can hear it.
Mm.
And then repeat it again one more time faster to get it for
the black
folks.
People.
Yeah, because they still deserve to get the joke the way that they're used to getting the joke. And then with black audiences, if it's predominantly black, I get excited because there's so many things I don't have to say. There's so many things I don't have to
explain,
worry about. Mm-hmm. You can almost not finish sentences with black people.
Right.
Man, why would you? Because that's... Da 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 da.
Right.
And that shit is like, it's almost like call and response. The one advantage to growing up in the South doing stand up is that you perform for a different demo every week. So I figured out early on, like, if you're doing a show for dope boys, and then you're doing a show at a casino for old white people, and then you're doing a mainstream room, I needed material that appealed to all of those demos concurrently without having to change the style. So stylistically, as I started out, it was a byproduct of just what rooms were accessible to me.
Here's what I've learned that's interesting about black and white audiences, because I had never really done all black audiences till like 2 years ago. Isn't that crazy? Who blacker than me, Roy? Nobody. But white people like I statements, individual statements. I did this. I went to dinner. Black people like we statements.
Yeah.
Y'all ever? Have you noticed that we like
black
collective?
People want to know that they're not alone.
Right.
And going through this world and experiencing the things that they're experiencing.
Moving along, at the end of the show, we like to do a word association game. That's where I say a word, and then you tell me the first thing that comes to your mind. Chicken sandwich.
Delicious.
Are you going to keep doing your chicken sandwich wars on Twitter?
I might do another chicken sandwich sketch.
Was that the Coalition?
Coalition. YouTube, that I can't even explain it. It's
yes.
Just, it's The Wire, but chicken sandwich.
But with chicken sandwiches. It's hilarious.
That's the only way I can explain it.
Alabama.
Misunderstood.
Television.
The perfect medium.
Waffle House.
Dangerous. Dangerous but delicious.
Culture.
Vital.
CP time.
Well, if we're talking CP time on Daily Show, itchy mustache. Because they glue a mustache on my face for that character.
Prank calls.
A staple.
Hip-hop.
Hip-hop is life.
Roy, thank you so much for coming on the show. I was so glad that we got you. You're like,
this was fun.
Such a cool person, somebody I really respect. You know your shit, you ain't full of shit, which is very hard to find in this industry.
I'll never forget when we met, and I was performing, I won't say where, but it was on the road, and Janelle just walks up to me and goes, hey, I'm moving to New York. we need to keep in touch. And I'm like, who's this? All right, whatever, motherfucker. See you in New York. And then sure enough.
That sounds about right.
Blew up.
Thank you so much.
You deserve everything.
Thank you. What I tell y'all, jokes for days, people. Make sure you check out Roy on Comedy Central the next time you're in for a good laugh. Thanks so much for tuning in this week for another episode of Strong Black Laughs. This show is produced by Strong Black Lead and Netflix with Pineapple Street Media. You can find us wherever you find your podcasts. Our jams are by DJ Don Will. You can follow him on Twitter at Don Will. I've been your host, Janelle James. You can find me on Twitter at Janelle J Comic. Make sure you follow Strong Black Lead on all of the socials at Strong Black Lead. And if you enjoyed what you've heard, don't be rude and keep it to yourself. Tell your friends and family about Strong Black Laughs. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to Strong Black Laughs on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.